There now follows a special broadcast by the Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Sir Mortimer Crisp, NP.
Good evening. Tonight, as I speak to you, we face the gravest crisis in our nation's history.
This is the Network News, Washington. I'm Dan Hickey. Good evening. Grave crisis in Great Britain as the tiny island of Maguadoro is invaded. The British Prime Minister sends in the troops in another desperate bid to cure unemployment.
All right, well done.
Support the President calls an emergency meeting with White House advisors.
We need to hump out wide, hype up the squeak bag before they screw down the jam box.
Escalation as reports show a possible Russian cover-up.
This is the dining room.
We regret to announce that all our dining tables are as booked up as can be.
The Russian premier was unavailable for comment. Stay tuned for more up-to-the-minute reports from Loretta Swift.
You're telling me that the entire population of Great Britain went and elected a deranged psychotic to the highest office of the land. Again?
Peter Cook.
Unemployment in this country is caused by pixies.
Ian Richardson.
What the world needs now is a miracle.
Alexei Sale.
See you later, alligator.
Michael Richards. And Rick Mayall.
All right, my sons!
There is no alternative.
Whoops, apocalypse.
Hi everybody, and welcome to the third episode of the Alexei Sale podcast. Now, I think it was last week and somebody emailed in asking a question about a sitcom I'd been in called Whoops Apocalypse, and would I talk about that? So I thought that it would be a great opportunity to reconnect with the two writers of Whoops Apocalypse, David Renwick, as he points out in the podcast, and Andrew Marshall, who wrote that sitcom, but also, of course, then went on to write with me three series of Alexei Sale stuff. And I think for the comedy aficionado, I think it would be it's a fascinating conversation between two or three greats of the comedy writing business. Obviously, David Renwick went on to write One Foot in the Grave, and Jonathan Creek and Andrew Marshall did 4.2 Children and Dad, all of them massively popular sitcoms. So anyway, enjoy this conversation between the three of us. We recorded it on a Zoom call, so it has that quality. It's not studio recording, but I hope that doesn't spoil things too much for you. So anyway, enjoy. This is me, David Renwick, and Andrew Marshall talking about Whoops Apocalypse and then stuff. And I'd like to say a big thanks to Jonathan, who was the one who asked me about Whoops Apocalypse. And he asked for my memories of that fantastic series, so I think you're getting loads of them. And stick around, we'll be back with some emails at the end. Well, this is fantastic. It's lovely to see you all.
Yes, it's not lovely to see me. It's lovely to see all of you.
Well, you know, this is where we are now. So we just had an email and somebody was asking about Whoops Apocalypse. So I thought, save me writing any material. And I think this will be most of the people who tune into my podcast, I think, are people who hate Keir Starmer. So this will please no one, hopefully. But I thought, seeing as somebody was asking, somebody emailed asking about Whoops Apocalypse, I thought we'd, it'd be interesting to talk about. So basically, David Renwick and Andrew Marshall.
Can I just intercept with the pronunciation of my surname?
Oh, yes. Renwick. Renwick. Yeah. Is it Renwick or Renwick? We've only known each other 40 years.
Yeah, no one knows. Yeah.
Renwick.
Anyway.
David.
I thought we might as well start as we need to go.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So, which is the correct pronunciation?
Okay, Renwick, take two.
David Renwick.
Yeah.
And Andrew Marshall. So I'll just, let's first, how did you
it's
get
it? Pronounced Marshall.
Okay.
That's the mistake I've made for the last 50 years.
50 years, yeah.
It feels like 50 years.
How did you get into the comedy writing game, first of all, the two of you?
Oh, God, are we going that far back?
Might as well.
Yeah.
I'll cut this into 17 different episodes.
Yeah, well, you'll have enough material for it, I think. Well, both of us pretty much at the same time, wasn't it, Andrew?
Yeah.
Weekending, that's where we met.
Yeah, that's right.
Early 70s.
I was a student at the time, and David was working on the Luton News.
Yeah.
Weekending was this sort of, was a quite a good, I don't know whether there would be an equivalent now really, but it was a radio show, a topical radio show that kind of burned through material, wasn't it? And a lot of the great writers of the time all worked on it. Is that correct?
Yeah, but it still wasn't very funny despite that.
No, it wasn't. It was mostly puns, wasn't it? And, sort of references. But it didn't need to be that funny because there was no studio audience, of course.
No, rather like
but
that.
But when we were working on it, was very, very early on in that, because it went on for quite a long while. And I think it was something like the second or third series that I joined it. Pete Spence had been writing nearly all of it. And then when Andrew and I joined, it was in the, I suppose, 71, 72, something around that time. And we met up at what was then the BBC Light Entertainment's headquarters at Iolian Hall in New Bond Street. We used to have sort of writers' meetings there, in the conference room, and people like Douglas Adams and Colin Bostock Smith, Alistair Beaton, John Lloyd, those were around that time. But I mean, we were about 4 years, I think, I worked on it. Probably you were the same, were you?
I think it was, about 3 years, something like that. And it was recorded on every Friday morning in a very strange studio around the corner from Broadcasting House called PP1, which was down in a sort of funny little basement somewhere. It's a bit like, it kind of felt like the BBC had totally forgotten about this other studio they had.
Yeah.
You kind of went
but
around.
Very
there.
Magical experience that was. I mean, I, as you said, I was still working on a newspaper, and every time I could get a Friday off, we used to go there for the recordings. And because most people, there were so many contributors from across the country who just sent it in. Hmm. But we were actually there on the spot, and that was proved to be a big advantage, just to get your face known. And
well, I think I used to spend a lot of my time. There was, I ought to just reverse a bit and explain. There was this sort of feature at the end of the program called Next Week's News, which consisted of a series of topical one-liners. And I used to stay up quite late Thursday night trying to write as many as possible, because I think you got like £2.50 or something for every line or something like this. And I became pretty good at this, so of course you just bring them in on the morning and give them to whoever was the editor or the principal writer at that time, which I think was Chris Milley usually in my day, and later Colin Bostock Smith. And, you might get two or three through if you were lucky and make yourself, enough for, I don't know, an ice cream or something.
I know those days you could buy a house in Hall, I would have thought.
Yeah, I was going to say, £2.50 luxury.
Yeah. So who were the cast, by the way, just to be complete?
David, Jason, Bill Wallace and Nigel Rees, all male cast, with Bill McGuffey at the piano doing the music.
Never it changed. Women were never in the news, so they didn't.
They did. They did occasionally bring in the someone just ad hoc, I think, didn't they? But I don't think that happened much during our era. I mean, later on, people like Alison Steadman and Tracy Ullman, and I think was Sheila Stiefel involved at one point. I can't remember now, but this was after we had left. I could go on for ages about Weekend, but that's where Andrew and I first met and decided to sort of try doing something together, didn't we?
Also John Mason, one of the other writers, was initially part of our sort of little group of people.
So what did you write? So what sort of stuff did you write then?
We wrote a pilot for David Jason.
And then we wrote it again.
Yeah. they were both recorded. Didn't get anywhere, but he was good, but the shows weren't picked up. he was known as the king of the kamikaze pilots at that time, wasn't he? I mean, he did so many pilots that weren't, didn't get anywhere. And then from that, we moved on to something called the Half Open University, supposedly parodying the Open University, which was broadcast on Radio 3. That ran for all of 2 episodes.
Yeah. 2 seasons of 1 episode each, though, let's be fair.
Yeah. About 5 years apart or something.
Then didn't you write for the Ronnies? I loved it when you used to say Ronnie B and Ronnie C.
Yeah, not to mention Ronnie H.
Ronnie H, who the hell is Ronnie H?
Well, Ronnie H was Ronnie Hazelhurst, the musical director.
The 3 Ronnies.
The 3 Ronnies. And, of course, there was Ron Waverley, who was Ronnie Corbett's road manager. So let's flesh it out. A little-known fact. But, yes, well, Andrew and I had kind of independent careers going on at the same time, I think. We're talking solely about our joint enterprises at the moment. Because how long have you got here? You know, I mean,
it's the internet. We could literally go on in real time forever, in a way. But
yes.
As I say, it will piss. People are going to be listening and say, "When's he going to start talking about the minutiae of Labour Party disciplinary process?"
Yes. Well, I'm very happy to talk about that.
Have you had the whip taken away, David?
That's neither here nor there. between me and the whip. Ellie and I have both resigned our membership. Let's leave it at that. But yes, but sticking with the... we weren't even very political. I wasn't very political on weekending in those days. I really hadn't, I mean, I'm ashamed to say now, but kind of hadn't really discovered politics. And that, you know, we used to write jokes about Dennis Healey's eyebrows and things. But there were people like Colin and Alistair Beaton, to their credit, had a much more political stance in their writing. And, you know, be that sort of influenced me a bit.
Yeah, I can remember a lot of very elaborate sketches about Watergate, which I never understood at all. In fact, I still don't entirely understand Watergate. I don't think even now, even having seen numerous reconstructions and things.
But do you remember that there was a memo came down from upstairs in the BBC to lay off Nixon? it's incredible to think now. Because, well, yes, we do tend to write quite a lot of sketches about him because, you know, it was during that summer of 1974, of course, that he had to go. I mean, we were very much, you know, we wrote a lot of stuff about Watergate. It was very much our era. I'd forgotten that. So yeah, a lot of those names, you know, became quite familiar because we were writing sketches about them all the time. Herbert Kalmbach.
Even though we didn't understand it.
Herbert Kalmbach. Do you remember the name Herbert Kalmbach? Who I think may
have. No, I don't remember that one.
What I remember was, yes, there was a Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean that went to the lyrics, Kalmbach, Kalmbach, Kalmbach. There's all that sort of stuff. It was you know, wordplay, a lot of it. But anyway, I stopped writing for Weekending, I think about 1974, which is when I left the Luton News. And I think you were still teaching, weren't you?
Yeah, I did a year and a half of teaching. And then I for some reason, London Weekend took pity on me and gave me a sort of staff writer's job. So I was sort of linked to London Weekend television for about 2 years.
And perhaps we should even describe what the kind of the topography was of TV companies, really.
Yeah, right. Well, I was just to sort of fill in the gaps. We wrote a series called The Birkis Way for Radio 4, which ran for 47 episodes in the end. Simon Brett, who had produced the first couple of series, was poached across to London Weekend by Humphrey Barclay. And he produced the first 2 series of our sort of Birkesy sketch series at London Weekend, which was called End of Part One. So we're getting close to...
what we were supposed to be talking about after an hour.
Yeah. Yes, because, well, End of Part One was a sketch show which was on at the same time as Not the Line of News, which hugely overshadowed our output at the time. And we were just determined when we kind of moved on to our next project that it would be something a bit more adult, that wouldn't be regarded as a children's show, which End of Part One always was, and got a children's show slot in on Sunday afternoons. And that's when we decided, let's make it about the advent of nuclear war. So we devised Whoops Apocalypse.
Well, if I could just talk about that. I mean, people, I don't know if they remember, but of course the landscape was, there was separate regional ITV companies, weren't there? So there was Granada in my home, like Liverpool, Manchester, Yorkshire Television, Central, and then the London, there was Thames during the week and then London Weekend Television at the weekends.
Mm.
And that was who you worked for, mostly. I mean, that's who you picked.
Yes, I mean, you had at least an opportunity there if your script or project was turned down in one area of trying to hawk it around one of the others. Which
jump
caused
in a car and drive to Leeds.
Yeah, with just putting some more local references. But
I'll go down Notley High Street.
Yes, up north. What happened, of course, was that we regarded then certainly that the BBC was the proper best home for anything that we cared to write. In those days, it had all of the infrastructure and by far the better resources, production quality, and all the rest of it, and treatment on air. So we took all of our projects to the BBC in the first instance. And it was when they were turned down there that we ended up taking them to Humphrey at London Weekend.
We used to console ourselves by watching Tom Brown's School Days, where they roasted him in front of the fire, which made us feel better.
Yes. As he was a child. Actually.
Or being dragged along by Bill Sykes in the streets of London, Victorian London. Yes.
So maybe, Andrew, do you want to describe what Whoops Apocalypse was actually about?
It was the events leading up to World War III, supposedly, in a series of vignettes in the various power capitals of the world. So it was kind of almost a series of two-handers in a way, wasn't it? And they all, by some cunning scripting method, came together in a nuclear war starting at the end.
Yeah. I think it was a natural kind of progression from our sketch comedy work. I mean, I remember being quite impressed and influenced at the time by that series Soap, the American series that Susan Harris did, and the fact that they were, every episode essentially consisted of two chunks of three big scenes, and each one had a strong set of characters and a strong premise to it. And as Andrew said, they all kind of interwove. And that's sort of how Whoops Apocalypse was, wasn't it? We had all these different locations around the world with their different sets of characters and comedy dynamics. And a prime minister who thought he was Superman. This kind of came up the other week when Trump came back from, having recovered from the coronavirus and was talking about pulling open his shirt to reveal a Superman logo, which was exactly what Peter Jones did in our series. And you just think, well, we have now reached that point in real life.
And then it went out on a Sunday night, was it?
Sunday night at 10, yeah.
At 10, yeah. And the good viewing figures, popular. You did two series.
There would no. There wasn't much left of the world after the first series.
Very
limited run, six episodes.
That was a real stupid mistake, really, wasn't it? That we
wanted another series.
Well, but, it spared us the ignominy of being cancelled, of course. But
why was I in it?
Well, that's a very still scratching our head.
There's two biographical, two kind of side things, isn't there? About Lenny Henry. Lenny Henry came to see me recording an episode, and Dawn French.
Yeah,
and they'd met.
That's where he met Dawn.
And they went off together to a jazz club, I think, in Covent Garden. But you remember our friend Dennis Burson also went with
him? I certainly do.
But they shook him off. And so that was where
that was the first time I met you, was when Dennis suggested we go off to the Comedy Store, which I'd never been to. And Dennis and Andrew and I were all working at that time on Bruce Forsyth's Big Night at London Weekend again. And that's where we went off. And I keep diaries of all these thing over the years, and I had a note about this comedian Alexis Hale, who was chairing the proceedings. But that was the first time you and I met, just very briefly. He introduced us because he was writing some stuff for you at that time, wasn't he, Dennis?
Yeah.
And then you did an Amnesty International appearance.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Secret Policeman's Ball. And Humphrey came in one day when we were doing our sort of pre-production casting sessions and said, I've just seen Alexi on that, and I really think he would be, he was electrifying, I remember was the word he used, and we should look, consider him for the commissar role. So you came in to read, and it's just another thing I remember that you saying, you'd started the script but hadn't actually finished it yet. You hadn't got to your part, that was it, which didn't bode well, and it closed the first half. So that was a good start. But anyway, you got the part of Commissar Solzhenitsyn, yeah, in the relation.
Yeah, yeah.
And the rest was history.
And then we made a movie. You made a movie. That was the first time I went to the States, and we all went to Miami, didn't we? Yeah.
Yeah. That was 86, January 86.
You were playing a different part in the film, weren't you? Because the film had a completely different story. I can't remember what the name of your film character was.
I have no idea, but I can remember the lines that I had. For some reason, like years ago, I played a taxi driver in a Spanish taxi driver in a film called Siesta. And I can still remember my lines in Spanish, which is, te puedo llevar al centro, pero se cobra más los domingos. I can take you to the center, but it costs more on Sundays. But also in Whoops Apocalypse, I can remember the Russian that I had to say, which was something like, dva živut, dvansk amerikansk journalistov, nada ich likvidirodov strazuje.
My God.
Yeah, for some reason. So whenever I talk foreign in a film, I can always remember it forever.
Wow. Isn't that astonishing? So, well, that's very impressive.
I can't remember anything else about the experience.
What I was going to say was, while we were making those scenes with Alexi, we spent a lot of time kind of sitting around in Key Biscayne, didn't we?
Yeah.
Probably quite near to Nixon, I think. Bringing him back into the conversation, and we got to know Alexi a lot better, and we discovered we got on really well.
Yeah, I had a note that we were at Old Crandon Park Zoo. Which was where we were filming a scene called Tinkerbell's Floral Wonderland,
yes,
which was a not very well-disguised Soviet missile base. And that's where it all got rather nasty, because I think your Alexis character then shot one of the journalists through the head.
Yeah.
But we were sitting around there, and that's where I remember us first saying, maybe we should get together and see if we can write a sketch show for the BBC. And unusually, when we got back to UK, we did actually pick up on that and came up with something.
Yeah, yeah. And
I forget what it was though at the moment.
As does everyone else.
It was the award-winning Alexi Sales stuff. There were amazing. I mean, we'll quickly hop onto, but it was an amazing cast in the. I mean, both the TV series and Cleese was in the TV series.
Yeah.
And then his part was taken by a young Michael Richards, next of Seinfeld.
That's
fame,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We originally had wanted Cleese to play the Prime Minister in the film. That was our first idea. And indeed, Cleese's company, Video Arts, that he co-owned with Anthony... they were going to finance it or seeking co-finance for a long while, and so it went through a lot of permutations, didn't it? Terry Hughes was going to direct it for a while, and we were looking at people like John Candy to take part, and
there was even a moment where Ken Russell was going to direct it, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah,
as it may seem.
Yeah,
he's making another one,
Yeah. Yes.
let's get on to stuff. So we sat down. You had a house in Milton Keynes, didn't you, Andrew? I think
I did. Yes.
Remember,
I'm afraid I did.
Yeah, and we wrote the pilot. And yeah, I mean, you had the idea of. I mean, you two had the idea of making it a kind of documentary, didn't we? Looking into the nature of.
Well, it was inspired by your Comic Roots episode, I think, which we thought that just seemed to work really well. Let's do that with some sketches.
It was just me walking and talking, doing sort of stand-up on location, which I think worked really well. But, I mean, I remember, I mean, the quality of the sketches in those, the first sketch about blaming the social services for the Crusades or whatever it was.
All of society's ills.
I mean, it's just brilliant. Those sketches were so fucking clever, weren't they? I was so in awe of that stuff, really.
Well, we did do some, it was quite a lot of stuff that I feel, worked really well. Andrew felt that was the sort of apotheosis of our sketch writing work, really, because I did feel everything kind of came together there, and the fact that it was that was the BBC as the rightful home of our work, I think.
It's extraordinary the resources we were granted for that show. I mean, incredible. I remember at one point the BBC built Mount Sinai in Studio One for a Moses sketch, which we finally decided we didn't think worked at all. So the whole thing was cut out somewhere on tape. There might be that sketch. I would love to see it.
That's what the BBC did there, wasn't it? You remember that? I mean, before that, and Andrew and I had worked on Spike Milligan's last series, and they would go, at Ealing, they would do all these amazing sketches for some, 15-second quickie that was absolute garbage out of Spike's delirious mind. And the attention to detail, you think, it's not worth this, really. But that's what they did in those days. There was no, pressure on them. So that was, we got the benefit of that, I think. And your song and dance routines were done with, a lot of polish and a lot of production value for the time, with no computer graphics or anything you get now. But I mean, I thought Marcus Mortimer, who directed those, really did made a sympathetic job of it.
I can just remember as well that, I mean, just those writing sessions that you'd come round, well, it's next door, but you'd come round here, the two of you, because we'd write separately, wouldn't we, I think? I mean,
and then David and I, to a certain extent, wrote separately and swapped things over and changed them. And
I remember David had the power because he had the typewriter.
He also had the brain, which was useful.
And I'm not afraid to use it.
I have to say they were quite almost the happiest days of our lives. Coming round, reading our sketches, having a good laugh, and then Linda would provide a lovely meal.
We'd go home very happy.
I just remember the food.
Yeah, but it was, I can remember just laughing and laughing and laughing at those sessions that we did. They were, yes, for me too, it was just an amazing and I guess that was, it was just a joyful kind of experience, wasn't it? And I guess that was transmitted to the screen, really, because that, it was a huge success, wasn't it, stuff, really? That's why they never fucking show it for some reason.
No. And I remember how depressed you got when the ratings dipped one week because it was opposite Miss World. What universe does the Alexei Sale audience desert us? Go and watch Miss World. But, that's what happened. This is, it just says everything about the fickleness of the audience out there. In the end, all you can do is make it for yourself, and which I think we've all done throughout our careers, really.
That's all you can ever do.
Yeah, and then occasionally you get lucky and find actually there are a lot of people who are enjoying it as well as you, but you have to just, and I'm not sure that exists anymore, that climate.
No, it was such a permissive time, wasn't it? That they just let you. I mean, I always say that, you'd make six shows for the BBC, and if it went down badly, they'd make another six.
Chiss.
There was now this cowardly kind of, and I always, you know, it's always, I mean, I've got a bit about, you know, that they were the last, I mean, they were the last generation of kind of producers who'd been through the war, and so, you know, they'd been Taylor and Charlie and a Lancaster. They weren't going to be intimidated by an angry tweet.
Robin Nash and all his life.
Yeah. And so it was, you know, they were so brave and so just, and now, of course, they'd made programs as well, so they weren't bureaucrats like now, so they, you know, they understood what was funny, I think, really. You know, so I just think...
Well, there were so, you know, there were so fewer tiers of government in the organisation. I mean, now there are so many different, you know, strata of people you'd have to go through. I mean, in those days, I think there was a head of Light Entertainment, who was Jim Moyer at the time, and then underneath him, there was a... You had... scripted narrative comedy and variety, and that was it, really. So you only had to really please two people.
Yeah.
And I think they had a certain amount of independence from the
control. Yeah, they could control, because I think now you have to, there's one person at the BBC who has to okay everything, because I understand it, so
I don't know.
And they only like programs about horses.
Well, that's true. That was our...
I don't know.
I don't think we ever used any horses, did we? We had elephants and tigers and camels and all sorts.
And that, well, I was saying to David last night, though, you know, it's taken me a long time to get round to podcasting, because, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, my model of working was I did something, you know, for a broadcaster. They then gave it authority by putting it out, and they paid me a shitload of money. Whereas with this, this is costing me money to give this shit away. I mean, how's this fucking... How has this happened?
Yeah. Can I point out it's not costing me anything?
Ah, that's what you think, but you're going to be cancelled tomorrow, remember?
In real life.
You get the bill. You'll get the bill. Yeah, we've accessed you. We've used this Zoom call to access your credit cards. It's actually an elaborate... This is an elaborate scam. This is not my house. I'm in the Ukraine.
Yeah, that link that you pressed earlier on.
Yeah, of course. You thought...
Your entire bank account.
He thought it was a Zoom meet. Yeah, it was a joy. I mean, it was a very exciting experience making it as well. And as you say, they had, the fucking, the buff, you know, the meals, the buffet that they used to.
This is, I think, the great tragedy about losing Television Centre. It's not the building. The building was nothing to do with it. It was the people. It was the expertise that was gathered at the BBC, the experience, you know, and the sheer talent. That's what I rather regret being dissipated, you know. I think that's a very sad thing.
Yeah, because they had everything. I mean, obviously they had makeup and the wig store and, you know, costume, and if you wanted the front end of an airplane, they had one, didn't they?
Yes. And then they just wound it all down, which was just it became such a sort of, you know, strange BBC mentality that they had this... built this vast rehearsal centre at North Acton, multi-storey rehearsal centre, which Andrew and I, I'm sure, have gone to many times. And it was like Hollywood Canteen going up there in the beginning of the generation.
It's the first time I had eggs Florentine. Because the canteen there, because it had like John Gielgud and Olivier, it was actually kind of Michelin-starred cooking, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, probably named some dishes after you.
Yeah, excellent.
But you know, the fact that they had all of that, I don't remember rehearsing Spike there as well, didn't we? And you know, you had all these specially sprung floorboards for the dance routines, and then they just, you know, just got rid of it all, and everyone ended up rehearsing in drafty church halls across the, you know, across London, you know, just wasted the whole thing. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I always felt very strongly was how impersonal an environment the BBC was to work in. I worked there a lot, probably individually as well, on the two Ronnies and things. And As Andrew said, you know, there are lots of, you know, great people that you, obviously you were alongside, but as an environment, it was curiously sterile, as opposed to London Weekend. And Andrew and I also work quite a bit at Thames in Teddington, and not necessarily our best work now at Teddington, but I loved going down. It was just such a, I don't know what you felt, right by the river, it was such a lovely, you know, sort of setting. And the people there were so warm and pleasant. You know, just so much nicer than I found at the BBC most of the time.
I always used to say getting the BBC to make your programmes was like trying to get your programmes made by the Church of England, which is kind of what it always felt. And these days it's like trying to get your programmes made by MI5, because you just have no idea what's going on there at all.
No.
I think for me it is fascinating. After we never really, you know, ever reflected on the process that we went through, but I could certainly do a lot more of this. I could talk, and you are both such luminaries of, you know, comedy, really, that you know, it's you know,
I have
really
had a lot
useful.
Of trouble with my luminaries recently.
I'm just trying to this is the first time I've ever done anything like this, so I'm being kissy ass, really. I think.
Yes, you are. Yeah. We're enjoying that particularly.
Yes, more please.
You are both such. You are such. Your light shines. So maybe we can reconvene this again, but see how it goes down with the listeners, really. But for me, it is been a. Fantastic. It's been, you know, and it's also, it recalls that joyful, I mean, just the you know, I mean, a lot of comedy writers are kind of miserable bastards, aren't they? Or maybe they're not, I don't know, but we always like, I mean, well, you're both very funny, really, in real life, IRL.
I don't know. Well, we certainly, what I can say, we certainly laughed a lot when we were making stuff,
yeah,
and it was enormous fun.
Yeah, it was brilliant. Yeah. All right, well, I'll sign off on that. No.
Okie doke. Thank you.
Lovely
David. To talk.
It's lovely to talk to you both anyway, and maybe we'll meet at some point.
Long may it continue. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Bye bye, everybody.
Bye
bye. Bye bye, City.
Bye bye, City. Bye bye. And we're back now. I'm just going to do some emails that you people have very kindly sent in. Tua Verheid asks, what do I think about Nevada Media and Double Down News and those various independent left-wing news organizations? I think in general, they're a really good thing. I, for a while, wrote a column in the Canary, and I think Kerry-Ann Mendoza is a much traduced but really interesting figure. And I think... Novara Media, Squawk Box, they don't always get it right. They can be partisan, but the mainstream media is a lying heap of fucking shite. So compared to them, and yeah, I think I watch Tisky Sour on Novara Media, and I would be happy to appear on that if they're listening. James emails and asks if I would do one of these about do an episode about the BBC, and I think that's actually an interesting one. I maybe interview Tom Mills, who's I know written extensively about the history of the BBC, without getting myself, I do work for the BBC, so it may not be too pungent, but yeah, I think, I mean, in a way, peripherally in this pod, if you listened all the way through, David and Andrew both reflected, I think unnostalgically, but just, you know, it wasn't like things were better in my day, but just, you know, what was great about the BBC and is now not great. And so, yeah, but I think an episode about the structure of the BBC and the politics, yeah, I mean, it's something that I'm fascinated by. So, yeah, we'll do that some point in the future. I say try not get myself sacked from Radio 4. Somebody else also asked about my ambiguous feelings about Tony Benn. I'm a bit knackered now, so I don't really want to get into that. But, you know, in many ways, actually, I have, right at the start of lockdown, I was obsessively reading his diaries, and it increased my respect for him. I think he's but there are some problems. I think partly with the reverence that he's held in, and partly with the man himself, in a way. But we can get into that at a later date. So I did say that a lot of people will be tuning in to hear some slagging off of the new leader of the Labour Party. So this comes from Joseph, and he says, I also wanted to share with you both a revocalization of the full titled name of the current leader of the Labour Party, Sir Keir Starmer. Without much effort, it is simple to pronounce Sir Keir Starmer as Suck Here Starmer. So there you go. Be assured, I do read all the emails that you send in, or at least the ones Talal shows me. So there's no point in emailing in, slagging me off, because I won't read that. So, I hope you enjoy this episode, and see you again next time. Bye! The Alexis L podcast is written and presented by me and produced by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarboosh Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. And remember, you can send in your emails to alexiselpodcast@gmail.com. Okay, bye.